the third case of the day, Sandra T. versus Grindle. Mr. Graveman.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Robert Graveman. I represent the defendant appellant, Karen Grindle, counsel. Karen Grindle, a school district, Berwyn School District 100, principal is entitled to qualified immunity in this matter because she did not violate any of plaintiff's clearly established constitutional rights. Plaintiffs allege two constitutional violations against Mrs. Grindle, one equal protection, and the second violation of the plaintiff's substantive due process rights. I'm going to first address the claim against Mrs. Grindle that she violated plaintiff's equal protection rights and argue that it is Mrs. Grindle is entitled to qualified immunity on that claim because there is no evidence whatsoever in this matter that Mrs. Grindle acted with any discriminatory purpose. Plaintiffs, in fact, concede as much.
Mr. Graveman,
yes,
could I ask you to just set the stage for us a little bit here in terms of what's still pending in the district court? What's set for trial? Which claims against which defendants?
Yes. Still pending it down in the district court. We're here following a denial summary judgment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are the two claims against Mrs. Grindle that are before this court, the equal protection and the substantive due process claim. There's also a state law claim against Mrs. Grindle, intentional infliction of emotional distress. The school district is also...
Is there a Title IX case?
There is against the school district.
Okay. All right.
Yes. And Mr. Spurlick, the band teacher, there's still claims pending against him as well. There are three defendants, that Mr. Spurlick, Mrs. Grindle, the school district.
Thank you.
To return, I was saying that Mrs. Grindle is entitled to qualified immunity on plaintiff's equal protection claim because there's no evidence whatsoever that she herself acted with any discriminatory purpose. And the plaintiffs concede as much. At page 10 of their brief, they say, Grindle's head-in-the-sand approach to the abuse subjects her to liability, not for intentional direct discrimination against the girls, but under the theory of supervisory liability. The district court's finding that Grindle faces potential supervisory liability for turning a blind eye to the abuse she knew her subordinate was inflicting is sufficient basis for defeating her assertion of qualified immunity on plaintiff's equal protection claims.
Could we talk about Nabosny for a moment?
Yes.
Because you argue that it establishes a requirement of discriminatory purpose.
Yes.
Now, of course, Nabosny involved harassment by other students, not by a subordinate. So it didn't even involve supervisor liability. So I'm trying to figure in my own mind how it can be relevant in determining the clearly established contours of supervisor liability.
Yes, but the Nabosny court says that a plaintiff must demonstrate intentional or purposeful discrimination to show an equal protection violation. Discriminatory purpose implies more than intent as volition or intent as awareness of consequences. It implies a decision maker singled out a particular group for disparate treatment and selected his or her course of action, at least in part, for the purpose of causing adverse effects on that identifiable group. In Nabosny, there was evidence that the plaintiff in Nabosny was a male student, and there was evidence that complaints of harassment by girls were taken more seriously and treated differently than his. So there was evidence of discriminatory purpose on the part of the supervisors. Here, there is no evidence that Mrs. Grindle acted with any kind of discriminatory purpose towards the girls. They say that perhaps she was trying to avoid a scandal, that sort of thing. Well, that's gender neutral. That does not evidence a discriminatory purpose. And the Iqbal, Ashcroft versus Iqbal decision of the U.S. Supreme Court recently has done away with supervisory liability. That case clearly states...
Entirely?
I don't think...
That's what Justice Souter says in his dissent. That's his observation.
Well,
Mr. Graveman, let me ask you a somewhat different question. I'm struggling with this a little bit. Suppose... Teacher Spurlick was simply harassing the African-American and Hispanic students in his classes, not the girls. And Principal Grindle knew about that and took the steps alleged to sweep that under the rug, to mislead parents about what the complaints were and so on. The factual record that we have to take for granted at this stage.
Yes.
Would it be enough for her to just say, well, I don't have anything against African-American students and Hispanics? Is that enough to get her out from under an equal protection problem when she's got the ability and the knowledge to step in and correct the problem?
I think under the analysis and the Iqbal decision, yes, that would.
How would that work, for example, just if I can expand to the, let's say to excessive force situations. In the supervisor who was on the scene says, well, I didn't mean to inflict any excessive force on this fella, but had the ability, opportunity, and knowledge to intervene and correct what subordinates were doing. Those kinds of claims go to juries all the time. Does Iqbal, does that change all that?
Well, they do go to the jury all the time. Yes, that's true. And in those cases, the supervisor is present and able to intervene at the time the act is occurring. There's no evidence whatsoever that Mrs. Grindle was present during any of Mr. Spurlick's actions towards
She's in the school, and we're talking here about a course of conduct over years, right?
Yes. Yes.
You know, you say there's no evidence that she was there. That was something that I wondered about, actually. After she hears about all of these things, how come she never visits the classroom to see what's going on in there?
Well, she testified at her deposition that she didn't in fact do that she, you know, made rounds to classrooms, including Mr. Spurlick's, and observed what was going on. It's part of her principal duties.
But obviously not enough.
Perhaps, but I don't think that goes to this issue. I mean, that's a fact question. I think.
I think
if this proceeds,
I think it does go to this issue because. If she condones it or turns a blind eye for fear of what she might see, then it certainly does go to the equal protection argument.
Well, I think that what that sounds in is a duty to protect or a failure to protect, to take some action to do something, and this goes to the substantive due process claim, I think, in the J.O. versus Alton case. There is no duty on a school principal or a state actor to protect students. That is the law of this circuit. Students are not among the special category where there's a duty to protect imposed upon state actors. Those are incarcerated persons or institutionalized persons who are no longer free to act on their own behalf. They have been restrained in a significant way, and that is the deprivation of a liberty interest that triggers due process protection. These students were always free to act on their own behalf, and their parents were. Mrs. Grindle met with the parents of the girls who made the complaint.
Well, the parents are, if the parents have the facts. Here's a woman who didn't give them the facts. She was hiding the letters. She was protecting this lunatic.
Okay, and there is no duty to protect the students. Okay, and hiding the letters.
She was protecting the lunatic. The children aren't the lunatic.
Okay, but that still is not the type of restraint that triggers a due process protection under the 14th Amendment, under J.O. and under DeShaney. Maybe that's a discouragement, but the kind of restraint that the law says is required is a significant restraint of a freedom to act. Discouraging someone from doing something is not restraining them from doing it.
Well, But the court in J.O. explicitly recognized the possibility that liability could be established where school administrators enact policy that allow child sexual abuse to flourish. Here she's allowing child sexual abuse to flourish.
Well, I think what perhaps you're referencing, Your Honor, is J.O.'s reference in the case to the Stone King decision,
right.
out of the, and J.O. doesn't adopt the Stone King decision. In fact, it's not even Ditka, it's discussion of it. It says perhaps plaintiffs could allege a claim, and here's this Third Circuit case that they cite. I said,
yeah, but I don't understand your argument there, because how is J.O. inconsistent with Stone King, given that the J.O. court itself believed that the two cases could coexist?
Well, I think, and I cite a Central District case that raises the inherent conflict in that, because the J.O. case says that to trigger a due process violation, there must be some significant restraint of the person's ability to act on their own behalf. And there wasn't that in J.O. There is not that in this case, and that's why there is no substantive due process protection implicated by what happened here. I see my light has gone on, so I have 5 minutes rebuttal. I'll reserve for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Mr. Lloyd?
May it please the Court. I'm John Lovey, and I represent the plaintiffs. We have to look at the context in which this case is being evaluated. The district court has made factual findings. We don't have to debate whether she actively concealed or didn't actively conceal. The district court's opinion says exactly that. It says, based on the evidence in this record, you could find that this teacher allowed the abuse to flourish, that not vicarious liability, not negligence, that she had personal involvement, that she personally could, if you credit our evidence, bear responsibility for the abuse that happened. And under clear law of this circuit, going way back more than two decades, if a supervisor turns a blind eye, condones, facilitates, or otherwise encourages the kind of abuse, then there is constitutional liability. And when you couple well-established law plus the facts the district court found, the appeal is dead. I mean, we've always viewed this as an attempt to do nothing more than scuttle the trial. The trial would have happened this summer. Ms. Grindle had a right to a qualified immunity appeal, but there's no merit to it.
Other than J.O., have you found any other Seventh Circuit case law recognizing the theory of liability that was set forth in Stone?
Well, our first response to that is there's myriad cases, because every case alluded to in Judge Hamilton's question where supervisors are liable, not for negligence, not for vicarious liability, but if they are personally involved in the conduct, if they conceal. So you go back to Jones in 88, Chavez, Nanda. Nobody's going to dispute there are a ton of cases along those lines before the Spurlick case. Now, then we get into, does it have to be on absolute all fours with this case? Does it have to be the exact same scenario? That's what is interesting about Stone King, because it applied it to an administrator facing just an absolutely stunningly striking fact pattern, where it was a band teacher who was doing it to girls, and the administrator's response was, stop being one-on-one with the girls. That's what's so stunning, is that Stone King couldn't be more on all fours. But this circuit and all circuits have never required exact conformity. But if you did need it, and by the way, the Northern District, the district courts in this district, we cited four of them, have all concluded that not only is it well established that the supervisor is liable under these circumstances, but that it applies to the school context. And obviously that wouldn't do it for qualified immunity purposes, but it is certainly telling that four district courts, Judge Grady, Judge Gettleman, have looked at the law and said that this law obviously applies in the school context. And I would argue that Nabozny also gives it to you. In Nabozny, they actually didn't have a supervisor because the offenders were students, but the court basically says no uncertain terms, if, in fact, you allow a climate to flourish, then a school administrator would be liable. And that case predates this one. And we can get into a debate about whether dicta qualifies or doesn't qualify, but I went back and looked at the Anderson v. Creighton case, which is cited in all the briefs, and that case says it can be dicta. I mean, we don't have to get into a fine line whether it was a holding or whether it was dicta. But, you know, I just to summarize, all that matters is that it was well established that a supervisor can't condone and turn a blind eye, and that's what happened here. We do have other cases. The Fifth Circuit case, the Doe case, also same fact pattern. And these cases aren't struggling whether it was clearly established. They're all saying it's very clearly established, and it applies seamlessly to the school context.
Mr. Lovey, what is the substantive due process theory add to your case here? Well, I understand your equal protection claim, but we've got, if we're talking about employers and employees, this sort of situation doesn't involve restraints on liberty. We don't get into that kind of problem.
We pled Fourth Amendment and substantive due process, and if I would have been in the district court, I would have allowed us to proceed with the Fourth Amendment claim instead of the due process, because as we know, due process sort of fills in when there's not a more specific right. And it seems to me the Fourth Amendment was a perfectly good remedy here, but the district court said no. It actually fits better under the substantive due process. And, Your Honor, it's very basic. You have a right to bodily integrity. I mean, an 11-year-old and a 10-year-old girl in school has a substantive due process right not to be molested by your teacher and not to have an administrator who's in a position to do something about it, to not only ignore it, but then to actively facilitate its abuse. That is clearly a substantive due process right. And when you couple that right with what the district court found, then quite obviously this is not a qualified immunity case. I mean, qualified immunity ultimately is a good faith defense. What school administrator could know that when five girls complain to her that this band teacher is being really creepy and he's touching us in inappropriate ways, and half of them are, alleging, more than creepy, they're touching breasts and touching pubic hairs. What school administrator could think she had a good faith right not only to ignore it, but to obfuscate, and if we accept the district court's conclusion, to actually conceal it, start lying to people? Now, in their statement of facts, they make her sound like, oh, she did things.
I wanted to ask you about that. Will the record reveal that she was visiting his classroom on some sort of a basis?
What the record reveals is that she's the principal, and she was responsible for visiting all the teachers in the district. She didn't increase the scrutiny of Sperlich anymore. So in other words, she visited him as much but no more than other teachers who were not drawing repeated complaints of pedophilia. So she was from time to time in his classroom. She allowed him to teach in remote areas. I mean, that's the problem. She allowed him to teach in basements. The sum total of what she did here was she told him to stop touching the girls. She told him to leave the door open. She told him stop complimenting the pretty girls, because that's what was so sickening about this. He was grooming for sexual harassment. He was only picking on the pretty girls. He was grooming them and would compliment them.
All girls are pretty.
Excuse me, Your Honor. And all of our clients are as well, Your Honor. But the point is, this was a man who was sick, and Grindel knew it. Because to give him a warning, like, come on, don't teach one-on-one with a girl. She knew she's a school administrator. That's not a solution for a pedophile. And we all trust when we send our kids to school that we're going to not get unconstitutional conduct. And that's exactly what it was. This idea about she didn't cut off other avenues, well, in a sense she did, because she lied. And when other administrators got involved, she lied to them. The district court let out, for example, the superintendent and the social worker. We thought the evidence should have been credited both ways. In other words, Grindel's saying, oh, I told them, I passed the buck to them. And they said, no way. She told us it was a pedagogical issue. She did not tell us anything. She didn't tell us about the prior complaints. And the district court said all the arrows are pointing to Grindel. So in a sense, he credited their testimony. We could have got the inferences both ways. But the district court's findings are pretty clear that all the other administrators have testified unequivocally that she was misleading them. We don't know her motive. Perhaps she was friends with Sperlich. Perhaps she didn't want a scandal. She was a new, inexperienced principal. Perhaps she was just in over her head. Perhaps once she had a number of complaints and she hadn't acted, then she's got to bury the problem and hope it goes away, because she never put the girl's letter in his official file. That letter didn't surface till after his arrest. So she clearly mishandled it from the inception. And then she continued to mishandle it. So why she did it is not the question. And if we look at the police case, let's turn then to equal protection, if we could. We do not believe that the supervisor must share the motive for this kind of violation. The police case is a good example. The sergeant, that's the one I'm most familiar with, if he has personal knowledge that his police officers are violating the Fourth Amendment or are beating people up or searching without warrants, he can be responsible as a frontline supervisor. He's someone who the Constitution expects he's in a position to do something about it, whether it's train or supervise or discipline or manage. And there's always been a constitutional claim for that supervisor. It does not matter that supervisor doesn't share the motive of the offending officer. You don't. If you say, are you liable for the Fourth Amendment violations, you ask if they're personally responsible and if there's enough culpability. They don't have to share the motive. The only wrinkle is this Iqbal case, which they cited in a letter yesterday. And frankly, I was out of town when the letter came, so we haven't had a chance to look at this, and we'd urge the court not to rely on this.
Well, I'm sure it was if there's any case that you would be aware of.
I'm familiar with the case,
Your Honor. I appreciate the late filing, and your point is well taken, but my view would be that that's not a hidden...
I have a response, Your Honor. I'd like
to... I'll hear your response.
My response is this. Iqbal is set to a specific kind of claim. Ashcroft was the top guy. He made a policy which arguably was facially neutral. He cannot be personally liable if his subordinates, way down the chain, misapply it, because he doesn't have any role in the misapplication of it.
No, it's the superintendent versus the sergeant.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's a different kind of claim.
And, are you basing that on just the numbers? In other words, the fact that Ashcroft probably has 100,000 people under his domain when you consider all the U.S. attorney's offices, et cetera, well, maybe not that many.
Yeah.
But
the entire Justice Department,
yeah,
sure.
Not
sure.
Many? Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Or, and the fact that, Ms. Grindle had, very few. Is that what you're basing?
Well, we wouldn't draw the line on how many people you supervise. I think the better line to draw here is, was it an affirmative policy or was it more the traditional failure to supervise? What Ashcroft did was he made an affirmative policy that's going to affect a whole bunch of people. And obviously the case law hasn't developed around it because it's a very new decision. But you can make an argument that if all he's done is made an affirmative policy and then it got misabused by supervisors, by the people on the front lines, that he shouldn't be personally liable unless he also harbored the invidious discriminatory motive. This is a different kind of claim. This is not an affirmative policy. This is the supervisor who had actual knowledge and could have stopped it, instead condoned it, facilitated it, turned a blind eye. That supervisor need not share the invidious motive. So to that extent, that would be the only potential even interesting argument here, is whether the equal protection claim survives separately from the due process claim because the supervisor needs share the invidious motive. And we would argue that's over-reading Iqbal. Iqbal is talking about a different kind of claim. And the supervisor here does not need to share the motive of the person, just like the sergeant doesn't have to share the motive. And, I got to admit that one came off my outline when Your Honor raised that question. Why can't we infer that she had a motive? Spurlick never said, I hate girls or I'm discriminating against girls. We're inferring Spurlick's motive because he only victimized girls. The same inference the jury could draw vis-a-vis Grindle. She's faced with a situation where only girls are being victimized, and she doesn't do anything about it. So to the extent that you needed a motive on her part, there's no reason why you couldn't infer it from the factual circumstances here any more than we're inferring it against Spurlick without a concession. So we don't even concede that if you decide equal protection requires the invidious motive by the supervisor, the jury could well find that Grindle shared Spurlick's motive. He obviously didn't share his purient motive, but the Constitution nonetheless recognizes liability.
I missed the word.
Purient. He wasn't.
Purient.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But that's never been a requirement either. So, Your Honor, because this is a qualified immunity case, you needn't get farther than the district court's findings. To summarize, the district court found exactly the kind of findings that have long supported a claim for constitutional liability for a supervisor for their own conduct, not for super respondeat superior, but for having an active opportunity to do something about it and instead misdirecting, concealing, lying. And when you couple those facts, there can be no argument that Grindle is entitled to good faith defense.
Just on this last point, if the record shows it, were these classes divided by sex in some way?
My understanding is that there were girls and there were boys, and he was victimizing the girls.
In other words, the boys and girls were together?
Well, they were band classes, and by his design or someone's, they were very small classes. So he didn't only teach girls, but the fact patterns turn out to be there's two girls in a room or, one girl in a room. And he was able to convince them that, it was a game. When he was arrested with bondage stuff in his house, and apparently this duct taping was for his fetish fantasy. So how do you get 10-year-old and 11-year-old girls to not tell anybody? He convinced them that it was a game and that, that they shouldn't tell anybody. And Grindle knew all this. The 11-year-old and the 10-year-old girls didn't understand it. Some of them very early on understood enough to know that they were being made very uncomfortable and that this shouldn't be happening and the constitutional liability should stop with Grindle. Perhaps she has a defense, but only a jury should decide.
Thank you. Scribner.
Yes, thank you. Let me first speak to the sergeant and superintendent. Those cases where the sergeant is held responsible for acts of a subordinate, the sergeant is present while the acts are going on. He is there, she is there, and able to intervene at the time, at the moment that the act, the beating, or whatever it might be, is occurring. The sergeant isn't back at the police station learning about it later and then saying, well, that's not a big deal or whatever it might be. That's the line of cases. And Mrs. Grindle, there's no evidence whatsoever that she was ever present at any time that Mr. Spurlock was engaging in any of these terrible actions. Mr. Lobey says that why she did what she did is not the question. Well, it is the question. It's precisely the question for the equal protection claim that they are raising. The Iqbal case says very clearly, vicarious liability is inapplicable to Bivens and 1983 suits. A plaintiff must plead that each government official defendant, through the official's own individual actions, has violated the Constitution. Purpose rather than knowledge is required to impose Bivens liability on the subordinate for unconstitutional discrimination. The same holds true for an official.
What page are you reading from?
I am reading, this is 19, page Supreme Court 1948 and 1949. The same holds true for an official charged with violations arising from his or her superintendent responsibilities. In other words, it is not enough that the subordinate has acted with some discriminatory purpose. The supervisor must also have acted with some discriminatory purpose. There is no evidence of that. The mere fact that this was going on and happening to girls is not by itself evidence of a discriminatory purpose on Mrs. Grindle's part. If we had evidence of complaints that boys had made regarding the conduct of a teacher and there was evidence that those were treated differently by Mrs. Grindle, then perhaps. But here all we have, it's no different than if I'm over 40 years old, if my employer terminates me, that's an adverse act as to me, certainly, but unless I can show that there was a discriminatory reason, i.e. it was my age, then there is no Title VII or no ADEA claim. The same would be here. Mrs. Grindle allegedly, and Mr. Lobey says the district court made findings. It didn't. It credited the plaintiff's testimony for purposes of summary judgment, as it has to do, but there have been no factual findings.
On that superintendent-sergeant analogy, if it applies at all, and considering Iqbal, how close to the scene is this superintendent? I mean, she is obviously not running the school district, and she's one of, I don't know how many principals there are, and I don't know how many schools, if the record reflects that.
There are three or four elementary schools within the district. At the time, this was K through 6. And she was the principal of one of the K through 6.
Is she located at one of those schools? Where is she? Okay.
She's located at Pershing Elementary. Mr. Spurlock was the band teacher for the district, so he would go
to the various elementary
schools, correct.
Is she then, at least at some times, on the scene, so to speak?
She's in the building. She's not at the scene.
Well, I understand. Even the sergeant who is condoning inappropriate conduct by a patrolman may not be in the squad car or in the squad room when a warrant is inappropriately executed. So I guess I'm just trying to see where we are as far as, frankly, the physical location and the venue, even though I understand no incident occurred allegedly in her site.
She had an office. Mr. Spurlock had a room in which he taught these band classes. He would teach, he taught the overall band, but he also taught, clarinet in one session and other instruments in other sessions of smaller groups. As my last point is to whether the law is clearly established, yes, it is important whether it's DITCA or whether it's part of a holding. DITCA does not clearly establish the law, and district court cases do not clearly establish the law. Stone King has never been adopted by this court. It was referenced in the JO decision. There are a lot of district court cases that reference it, but this court has never specifically adopted it, and it conflicts with J.O., and it certainly conflicts with Iqbal. Unless there are any other questions, I think my light is going on, and I thank you all very much.
Thank you, and thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.